like scary movies?
Uh-huh. I'm getting ready to watch a video.
You making popcorn?
Uh-huh.
What's your favorite?
I don't know.
You have to have a favorite. Talk to me. Talk to me.
Hi, everybody. I'm George, and welcome to a very special episode of The Best Little Horror House in Philly, the show where we talk about the best horror movie ever made. According to our guest, at least. And today's guest is the only possible choice for this one. Who else for the follow-up to episode 100 with my dad, but episode 200 with my mom? Please welcome Sophia Heffler.
Hi, everybody. I'm so excited to be on with George.
Well, we're very excited to have you here as well. Why don't you tell us a little bit about your history with horror?
When I was a teenager, I loved horror. And going back even when I was younger, I don't know if you all have heard of this show or if they made a remake or what, but there was a show on Saturday nights called Creature Feature, and it was my one treat of the week was that I got to watch Creature Feature, and that's where I met the werewolf. Mm. And we lived up in the woods,
yeah.
So I was pretty darn scared of the werewolf. But I loved slashers. I loved, you know, anything with Jamie Lee Curtis in it. I loved horror. Which is something that I would not normally do. If none of my friends were available, I would actually take the bus and go see movies myself.
Wow.
Because Kirby, my best friend, wasn't quite as into horror as I was. She was more sappy romance.
Mm-hmm.
So, and then, as I got older, I really didn't, I wasn't like, oh, let's go to the movies and see Freddy Krueger kills XYZ person. And I'm certainly not a what do you call him? Who's his name? The big giant gorilla.
King Kong.
I'm not into anything like that, mm-hmm. And, you know, but I love suspense.
Mm-hmm.
And I will tell you that part of that reason is because I'm a huge, huge, huge true crime addict.
Right.
Addict. I pay to watch them and I just love them. And one time George told me something bad about one of the hosts and I stopped watching for a year and I couldn't take it anymore. So I was like, I'm sorry, George. I said, he may be on the other end of the aisle or whatever the case may be. I said, but he's got a damn good podcast. So I am totally into true crime podcasts. And part of the reason why I picked this movie is that it's very real. It's mm-hmm. very real and it's very relatable to things that go on today.
Definitely. For sure, growing up, true crime was a fixture on the TV, lots of
snapped
cold case files, the first 48.
Forensic files was my favorite. And it wasn't forensic, like nursing, wasn't something that they really did back mm-hmm. in the day that I, you know, went to school. But the forensic nursing just fascinates me.
Yeah.
You know, and the whole forensic, you know, they take a little piece of a root of a hair mm-hmm. and they can identify who the person is if they're in the CODIS system. So, all right, enough about true crime.
Well, this isn't a true story, but it is based on a true story in which a bank clerk kidnapped and killed a woman that he had a crush on in England. And it does hew extremely realistic. And as you said, it's very clear to me that, you know, you prefer this to fantastical stuff, even when the story is nevertheless fictional. So, I think that this choice made a lot of sense. Would you say that specifically true crime is your favorite subgenre or suspense at large?
True crime.
All right. Fair enough. Fair enough.
I love it so much. I'm running out of old podcasts to listen to.
Well, there you go, people. Send in recommendations for
my mom.
Come on,
I sent money. Show me some new stuff. I do support George.
That's absolutely true.
Financially with the, not like in real life, but right. Just on podcast life.
She is a longtime patron.
And not only that, his biggest fan and also his marketing director.
Yeah, she loves to tell people, loves to go around telling people about the show. And who knows? It may have paid off multiple times. So
I'm telling you, if I see one day I walk into the Michael's store and there's a guy and he's wearing a hoodie. It's black and it's got a skeleton on the whole thing down the pants.
Uh-huh.
So he's into horror,
sure,
right?
Sure.
So he was one of the people, he and his girlfriend, that I went up to and said, "Psst, buddy, you like horror podcasts?" I said, "My son has the best horror horror podcast that there is out there, and you need to listen to it." And I wanted to have cards printed up.
No, I said no.
But George wouldn't let me.
I said, please, no. But if that guy from Michael's is out there listening right now, hello. Hope you're enjoying the show.
Hi, guy. Well, I want to tell your history with horror.
Oh, boy.
I've been dying for this whole time. He's been doing the podcast. And believe you me, I watched everyone and multiple times. But George's first experience with horror, I'm not going to give you his first. I'm going to actually give you his second, was that we thought, since his name was George, that it would be nice to go see George of the Jungle with him and his older brother and me and dad. So we get all seated, we get our popcorn, and the movie starts. The movie starts, and you know, like a gorilla sound. Well, it makes the gorilla sound. And all of a sudden, I see George come across the aisle and up the aisle, out of the movie, into the lobby, terrified. And this was George of the Jungle.
Look, people out there, first of all, I was very, very young.
You weren't very, very young. You were at least 3 or 4. So, I mean, you had to be able to watch a movie.
Okay. But then on top of that, the speaker was not working at first. So it was very quiet next to us. And then out of nowhere, it finally starts working again. And this thing just screams in our ear.
Oh, my God, the noise.
And so I screamed back and I got the hell out of there.
He did. Wait, it gets better. We went back a second time to try it. And same thing. We sat in different seats, everything. Same thing. As soon as the gorilla noise starts, you know, with George flying through. George flies, you know, out of the theater into the lobby.
That's right.
And finally, for the third time, I said to him, "Listen, kid, we're not driving there again for nothing. And paying for the, you know, they didn't give me my money back or anything, or paying for the movie for 4 people 3 times. So you better sit and watch this movie if I have to put a long tie and tie you to the chair." And he made it through. He made it through. And I think that his 3 exposures made him really like horror. It made him, he felt it so viscerally.
Mm-hmm. I had to work through it. I went through the terror.
First time I let him get away. Second time I let him get away. And third time is, this is not a horror movie. Sit down and watch it.
Well, but I would accept it as a horror movie on the show.
It definitely, I think, helped get him more into horror because he came to realize that, you know what, this is fake.
Mm-hmm.
And I can sit here and watch this guy screaming all day.
Mm-hmm. It's true.
You know?
It
so
is true.
It was for a parent to see. I hope this makes the cut.
But the movie we're talking about today is 1965's The Collector, adapted from the John Fowles novel of 2 years prior, which we both read as well. One of the main differences is defined in a quote from the director to the star, where he said, "We're not making the book, we're making a film." And so there is necessarily some stripping down of stuff that I do think are interesting thematically, but probably complicate things too much. And so I'll talk about those down the road a little bit as they come up, but it is pretty faithful from a larger scale perspective from book to movie in a way that I think makes it a good adaptation, because it's not 100%, but it's close, that you feel like you're getting something similar but different at the same time.
Yeah, I thought that it was something really neat that, you know, the way that played out with its similarity to the book. Mm-hmm. I think that's one of the... I'm a big book person, too, true crime and other things, sociology and things like that. But
Memoirs,
John Fitzgerald. I have a dog, the Great Gatsby, but that's aside from the point. And two grand kitties.
That's right.
Who I love to death, even though they don't let me pet them. But I think that of all the many books and then watching the movies that I've seen, I've always been like, the movie was just so-so. Mm-hmm. It doesn't compare to the book.
Right.
I did not feel that way with this particular rendition of the book. I felt very comfortable in reading what I was reading and knowing, you know, they don't want you to know what to expect, but because I watched the movie three times first. Because I watched this movie years ago, and I kept telling George, you have to watch The Collector, you have to watch The Collector. I'm like, it's not really horror, but it's suspense. It's like, it's really Alfred Hitchcockian. And I said, I don't know if that's a word, but it very much so reminds me of Hitchcock.
Definitely. Yeah, and, you know, and I said the same thing then that I'll say now, which is, as far as I'm concerned, suspense is horror, so... Fits the bill, definitely. The movie is directed by William Wyler, who's an icon in old Hollywood, thanks to his work on, among others, the epic Ben-Hur and record-setting 12 personal Oscar nominations. And he was looking for a comeback, in quotes, since despite the combined 17 Oscar nominations for his previous two movies, Ben-Hur was considered by some critics to be a commercial parasite. And the following movie, a remake of a previous one with a lesbian element added back in to challenge the production code, saw mixed reviews. So he was looking for something to get him back in the game. And he was in the middle of pre-production on The Sound of Music. And he was, in fact, the one who saw Julie Andrews in My Fair Lady, got a hold of the Mary Poppins dailies, and hired her for this legendary role. But he said that he had some serious misgivings about the movie. Not about its quality, he was sure that it would be a success, but he was having the same tough time with the setting that I personally, George, do as well, which is specifically that it's set in Austria during their pre-World War II glad-handing of history's greatest villains. His quote was, "I can't bear to make a picture about all those nice Nazis."
Oh, gosh.
So basically, he's looking for an out. When what should fall into his lap but Judd Kinberg and John Kahn, two TV writers looking to break into production, bring a pre-publication copy of the novel that would end up being a smash hit in and of itself, a completed screenplay adaptation, a deal with Columbia Pictures, and Terrence Stamp in mind as the title role of Freddie Clegg the Collector. So Wyler agrees to read it, though he goes for the book first and, quote, devours it. He said, "I couldn't put the book down, and I'm a man who can put down books very easily." So now we have Wyler on board, and Terrence Stamp, as I said, is being hounded by the producers to star as Freddy. And he's a great actor, he's already seen some acclaim for Billy Budd in 1962 with an Oscar nomination, but he hasn't made a movie since then, while still being in the media eye for a series of high-profile romances. And so this combo had impacted his self-esteem, and he kinda needed this. Their persistence and the news about Wyler joining wears him down despite his concerns about being right for the role. He basically demands to go through the screen testing process to give Wyler a chance to fire him. And I find this to be pretty interesting as a reflection of the character's inferiority complex. It's this exact reaction that makes him perfect in a way. Yeah. My mom is doing his little slouch that he does when he feels beat up upon.
When he gets nervous.
Yeah, he looks like Richard III.
I was like, what the hell?
Yeah.
And then I figured it out. I'm like, oh. And I'm not being facetious or mean or nasty or anything like that, because that's not who I am. I love all people. But it looked like he was on the spectrum. Mm-hmm. For autism. It looked like at the very least that he had Asperger's syndrome.
I would believe it. You know, especially in the book, you see him talking about how difficult it is to connect with people and how you know, part of what he admires about Miranda is that she just knows what to say and that she's able to walk into a room and you know, everybody likes her.
She's sophisticated. She's, yeah, right. She's gorgeous. She's got that red hair, mm-hmm. you know, her legs. Her legs, when they show the scene of her leg making the water come back on, mm-hmm. oh my God, I was like, I wish I had legs like that. My God. She was sly.
Mm-hmm. She certainly was.
She was definitely sly.
Yeah.
And, you know, every chance she had, she tried.
Yeah, she wouldn't be a very good prisoner if she didn't try to escape. So the screen tests go well for Terrence Stamp. And he told a funny story in the Blu-ray special features about going to see Wyler and his nerve gives out and he just blurts, "Did you see the tests?" And Wyler just nods. And Stamp says, "Well, you don't want me." And Wyler just nods again. And Stamp goes, "But in the book," and Wyler stops him and goes, "We're not going to make the book. We're making a film, a thriller." And they were the first words I heard Wyler say. And of course, from then on, I was just his creature. So, fun quote.
I had never heard of him before, but I was quite impressed that he gave up The Sound of Music to direct this.
Yeah.
They only got a little bit amount of money to make the movie,
right.
And I think they did an amazing job with it.
Definitely.
And I also thought that it was interesting that the indoor scenes were done indoors on a set
right.
in L.A., and the outdoor scenes were done outdoors in England outside that beautiful house,
mm-hmm.
which became a house of horrors.
Certainly was. Yeah, I think that it does work. You know, the filming on the soundstage, there's kind of a minimalism in it because it's built that I think works. It creates kind of a claustrophobic tension in tandem with the silences in a lot of the moments instead of score. Kind of a bold stroke considering the minimalism of the story itself, which is just two characters basically in one situation, shows a lot mm-hmm. of faith in them to be able to carry it and make it interesting.
Did Wyler win an Oscar for his direction of this film?
Yes, it was his last.
Yeah, I was going to say, I thought I saw that somewhere.
Yep.
Made a good choice.
Yeah, he certainly did. So Stamp's co-star that emerges from these tests as Miranda Gray is Samantha Eggar, whose chemistry with him is impacted by the fact that they not only studied at the same drama school, but that he had indeed unrequitedly admired her from afar. And Samantha was a lot less impressed by Wyler, as she self-admittedly had no real knowledge of American films, and contextually, it took a lot more effort to gather knowledge at the time. The auteur movement is still in its infancy, so there's not exactly libraries worth of biographies or analysis the way that there is now, and there's simply no easy form of home media to explore a back catalog. And then on top of that, auteur theory has difficulty with versatility like Wyler showed, and so there isn't really that much talk about him anyway, because it's like, he is so versatile and his movies are so varied that people have a tough time assigning like an authorial stamp to him, even though you can see some of the things, especially like his interest in stairs and what they can represent, does show up in a lot of Wyler's work.
Yeah, he's something going up those stairs.
Yeah, definitely.
Six at a time.
Yeah.
And then going downstairs with her, mm-hmm. you know.
Definitely.
It was like, this guy thought he was being so good to her, totally missing the fact that she just became part of his collection.
Right.
Just like one of the butterflies. And when she saw the butterflies, he was expecting, "Whoa, butterflies, yeah. How beautiful." And he got the complete opposite reaction. She was horrified.
That's right. So there are two versions of their working relationship that people have discussed throughout the years between Eggar and Wyler. The harsher view seems to be the generally accepted version, but was also denied by Samantha in multiple sources across decades. Now, it seems possible to me that there's a little whitewashing in action there, but understandable considering the way women were treated in the movie industry, not just now, but especially back then. And these rumors concern utilizing some Hitchcock-style performance-eliciting tricks and treatment, specifically the character-based isolation that persisted beyond the bookends of action and cut. She couldn't leave the set during the day, she ate with just her acting coach, and Wyler and Stamp were both pretty cold towards her. And it was emotionally challenging, to be sure, but she said in the special features that it was just what was on the page and a result of her constant rehearsal on a small set with only a handful of people. And she told the New York Daily News, quote, "I guess I was supposed to feel trapped, and I did. At first, I just felt I couldn't do it. It took me 5 weeks to get on Wyler's wavelength, but when it's over, you realize you've done the best you could do. It's very satisfying for an actress." So, you know, hard to say exactly what went down without being there. She seems to have recovered, at the very least, from any attitude that she received, but felt it was worth mentioning.
In my research, I actually saw a lot of references to the Me Too movement. Mm.
Sure, you know, that makes sense.
In regard to this movie.
Yeah. I mean, not just the topic, but yeah.
So I got, you know, really good resources.
Sure.
They weren't like from 1965. By the way, I'm from 1964.
So there you go. So those 5 weeks did include some pitfalls, and she was initially refusing to accept the help of the acting coach that I mentioned earlier, since Marilyn Monroe had just been roasted in the press for that. So she was fired. But Wyler was still confident that she was the right pick, and when she agreed to the help, he reversed that decision. She came back on board. And what he did to help as well was, atypically for the time, shot in sequence to help her stay in character, including the slow diminishing confidence, instead of having to constantly thread the needle over and over again. I also couldn't confirm this, but there was an interesting claim in a contemporary promo that Samantha Eggar was on screen more per minute than any other woman in a movie to date, which I thought that was an interesting fact.
I didn't see that. That's interesting.
Yeah. And one interesting change that revolved around Eggar was the movie was intended to be shot in black and white. Wyler feared that the color would act as a phony, exaggerated distraction. But when the cinematographer did a black and white test for Eggar, he also did a color one, and her gorgeous red hair was enough to convince Wyler to switch. This also opens up the opportunities for some interesting lighting. The cellars are famous for being previously used as a secret Roman Catholic chapel, so they included some really cool pink hues that, in tandem with the churchy music in those scenes, do give the impression of stained glass and a holy space, which, of course, for the titular collector, it is.
Yeah, it looks totally like a holy space. It has those arches all over the place.
Right.
And I'm not sure how far back they go, but it looked like it wasn't small.
No, it was pretty sizable for sure.
Hello, kitty!
Lula just came in to say hello as well. So they wind up with a 3-hour movie, and Columbia is like, no. you can't do that. So he cuts around an hour out, including a half hour of prologue via flashbacks, featuring Kenneth Moore as Miranda's teacher and quote-unquote love interest, although it's not really that simple, and several images of him that help to keep Miranda going. But while Wyler is pissed, saying some of the finest footage I ever shot wound up on the cutting room floor, including Kenneth's part, I think it's a good call, because now the strength comes from inside and her own resilience, as opposed to simply remembering and wishing for a different man. And it means it cut out this passage from 235 pages in, comparing him with the love interest from Emma, where she said, "They both have the one man's name I really can't stand, George. Perhaps there's a moral in that." I said, what the hell?
Sure.
Suddenly she just looks directly out of the book and insults me.
I didn't send that to him. I have the heart.
But so this is where I wanted to discuss some of the book themes, because they do relate to George, the character
totally,
that was eliminated.
Yeah.
When accused of the book being fascist, Fowles said that it's not necessarily about class division, but psychological division. The few versus the many, which George, aka GP, explicitly is the few, and Miranda aspires to it. That yes, Freddy commits evil, but he's a product of his environment, and that Miranda is not to be wholly commended on her attitude either, as an embodiment of, quote, university student surety and snobbery, which is extremely visible in her diary, also eliminated from the movie. There are two quotes that I pulled from that I feel sort of demonstrate this eliminated theme, or not eliminated, but less fixated on. She's less cruel, understandable, though, that her response may be. So these are the quotes. She said, "I'm so superior to him. I know this sounds wickedly conceited, but I am. And it's so Ladymont and Bodeica and noblesse oblige all over again. I feel I've got to show him how decent human beings live and behave. I hate them. I hate the uneducated and the ignorant. I hate the jealous and the resentful. I hate all the ordinary dull little people who aren't ashamed of being dull and little. I hate what GP calls the new people. The new class people with their cars and their money and their tellies and their stupid vulgarities and their stupid crawling imitation of the bourgeoisie." So she definitely is like youthful passion for morality and surety in a way that definitely you see her feeling those ways in her enjoyment of art and her passion for things like The Catcher in the Rye and Picasso. But she is less cruel, which makes us a little more on her side and in the movie, I feel like, as opposed to...
Yeah, when I read that, I was like, oh my God, she's a maniac. She's she hates him and she's going to wind up killing him.
Right. Yeah, it is.
Because he's not the right class, the right clothes, the right this. And you know, I understand. Freddie was the bad guy.
Right.
I felt bad for him in some of it. I mean, you know, again, he thought if he bought her all of these things and made her very comfortable and took her for her weekly bath, that she was going to be okay being his collecting piece.
Right.
I just, you know. It is sad.
It is sad, yeah. Because he is warped, and it is, as Fowl said, partially a product of his environment, and yeah, definitely, you know.
Well, yeah, he was raised by his aunts.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
He didn't have a mother. I don't know what the story was there, why he didn't have a mother.
Right, yeah, and at one point Miranda even psychologically analyzes him and says, "You're looking for a mother." But, yeah, I also think that what this change does is – It creates almost more of a possibility. The gulf between them is not quite as large. And I think it really ties into the tagline, which is almost a love story. I think that's a really great tagline. I think it is sort of captures the tragedy of what we see on screen in a really great way.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's there are so many scenes that are, again, I know Freddie's the bad guy. Feel so bad for this guy. He's trying everything, mm-hmm. You know, and, you know, he would have given her anything she wanted with his money, but no,
money can't buy everything.
So.
Yeah.
I don't think so.
So the movie comes out in June 1965. It is a huge hit that sort of redeems Wyler's career in critics' eyes. It's simplified in a good way. Nominations and laurels aplenty as soon as its Cannes premiere, including the final Best Director Academy Award for Wyler himself. So a big critical smash hit. Let's get into the movie itself. It opens with young Freddie Clegg springing joyfully through a field in pursuit of a butterfly, which he captures and carefully bottles in what's called a killing jar. Although that you don't know that in the movie. You have to learn that from the book. This chase leads him to a large house for sale, which he explores, seemingly stunned at the place. Its isolation and unattached cellar perfect for his plan to kidnap art student Miranda Gray, who he has been stalking. One thing I really love about the book that I think it comes across a little bit, in his voiceover, but that they do such a great job of showing his delusion, is that he's constantly telling himself that he didn't even think that it was actually going to happen, that he did all these things just in case, like, oh, I had other reasons to do these things and to buy this house and to start cleaning up the dungeon just to see if it could happen.
And it was a dungeon,
right.
Even when he cleaned it up.
Yeah, exactly.
It was so dark and eerie, and the archways. I don't know. It gave me the willies.
Definitely.
When I saw it.
And we do see this terrifying hunt in action, as deliberate of movement as the initial butterfly chase. A moment of visual irony as she heads into the underground, which she will spend most of the movie underground anyway.
She does spend most of the movie underground.
She certainly does. And there's a wild piece of this action where she emerges and we see her in the side mirrors. And she gets bigger and bigger in it as his obsession grows. But also just from a technical perspective, it does a really cool job of like implying his presence without actually showing it. Then, not seconds later, she passes a theater that's showing Ben-Hur, which is fun. You know, it's a little Wyler saying, hey, critics may view it as selling out, but here it is still showing all this time later, so. And we also see the chloroform in his glove box, in his glove compartment, way before he actually attacks her.
What was that, a little, like, knock you out kit? It was a little bag, and it was like the burn.
Yeah, he builds a little pack. He's ready to go. Just in case.
Yeah. And he's driving around with it just in case.
And yeah, so the tension has plenty of time to build. And he follows her into a bar where she's immediately swarmed, but she demurely heads for the back where we see the only remnant of the opening of the book. She inaudibly confesses her love to her art teacher, who correctly declines. And this soft close-up of her pained face is very nice, very gauzy. Just looks really good. And she hastily leaves the bar, and he springs the trap. He blocks her path with the van, and it looks really, really good as it's a wider shot, and she just disappears behind it, and then there's a pause and a scream. Nice way to not force it, right? It's locked down and lets your imagination do the work.
Yeah, my imagination was going crazy when she was walking back there.
Yeah,
I'm
sure.
Like, oh my God, he's going to chloroform her and take her to the basement.
That's exactly what he does. And as the van screeches to a halt at the house, the music is really interesting. There's moments of soaring and joy in it that belie the situation. But only because the movie is from Freddy's perspective. We've already heard voiceover, which lets us know as much. And of course, he's thrilled. It all went perfectly as far as he's concerned. And in she goes to the dungeon.
Yeah. You know, I don't know. Did you read anything? You mentioned the music here.
Mm-hmm.
Did you read that the music kind of got panned? I was like, huh?
Well, I feel like people don't let it be part of the perspective, right? A lot of people say it is kind of like, it doesn't feel like it fits in all the time because it does have those joyous moments, those churchy moments. But when you let it sort of be part of his view, when you say this movie is from his perspective and he views this as a holy place or a moment of great joy, I think it does work and it actually is perfect for the movie.
Had I not read the book first,
mm-hmm.
and I just watched the movie at the beginning, I would have thought it was like The Sound of Music with him running around in the meadow with the flowers.
That's
and
right.
Then he catches the butterfly. It looks so like, oh, this is such a sweet little movie.
That's right.
They totally changed it from the book.
It's almost a love story.
It wasn't changed.
But the dungeon has been transformed into something not quite what we expect, which I think really sets you off balance that you don't expect it to have all these like nice furniture and stuff in there. He also makes sure to pull her skirt over her knees and pull hair from her lips as he carefully lays her down on the bed, which is further not really what you'd expect, this carefulness with it.
Yeah.
And Freddy locks her in with the door hidden behind some shelves, and he rushes out into the rain to literally frolic. A moment of release for him, as it is for the clouds.
See, lots of frolicking.
Yeah, he's a frolicker, no doubt. And it's here where we see the sort of inciting incident via black and white flashback. All of his co-workers laugh at a prank on Freddy that involves his passion for mounting butterflies. He is a sullen man with no friends that just lurches through the room to receive a message from his aunt. It is an exciting one, though. He's just won 71,000 pounds on the football pools. People might not know what the football pools are. This is a low cost of entry way to gamble that started in 1923, similar to the lottery that saw 14 million UK residents playing weekly at its peak. Basically, all the soccer games started at 3 p.m. on Saturday then, and you'd guess how many would end in a draw to try and win the jackpot, which is exactly what he's done.
Did you look up what the dollar amount would be?
No, I didn't. Did you?
Yeah.
Good. Let's hear it.
In 1965, in American dollars, his 71,000 pounds equaled 2,426,060 cents. Okay, because this gets really better. My eye was on this prize. If he had saved all the money today, he would have had $703,988.14.
Interesting.
Because I was like, what's $71,000? So I had to look it up. But yeah, he won a, that was a decent amount of money to win.
No doubt, no doubt.
I saw what today's money equaled. I was like, whoa.
Well, and it's interesting too, because in the book, Miranda talks a lot about like money is for spending. Like, it, you know, you have to put it into use. And that is what he's doing. And she like sort of views herself as like helping him in this way as well, as like put it back.
Money.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
I'll take one of these and one of those.
Yeah. There is also a really nice match shot as both Freddie and Miranda come out of their reveries. She is terrified, as you might expect. Looks great as the even more strange than usual elements dawn on her. Red light aglow as she pushes on an ornate mirror, her self-image warping in more than one way, perhaps. And her introduction to him was phrased really well in the commentary. They said, she's expecting a monster, but she gets a butler.
That's the truth. Him and his tray.
That's right. His gentle first words are, I hope you slept well. And she's confused. She says, if you think my parents are rich, you've got another thing coming. So he says, it's not that. She doesn't know his motive. And he steps out again, and the headline, we see him pull some newspapers here. This is one of the only things you get from the outside regarding the capture, which I think is really interesting, that we are as cut off as she is, basically. And she does ask about his motive, and it's really well acted, but additionally, part of Miranda's problem throughout the movie is something we experience as well, which is a terrifying failure to grasp exactly what's driving this guy. He says, I want you to be my guest. What kind of answer is that? We don't find a ton out.
My guest?
Yeah. He's going full Angela Lansbury on him. We don't find out a ton more about this guy, which keeps the terror alive. Because how can we predict his responses if we can't glimpse the interiority? Really helps you empathize with the victim's fear in a way that I think does improve from book to movie. As we lose sight of his interior, it becomes more scary, I think.
Yeah, definitely. You know, because we see him in action.
Right.
You know, at that point. You know, this little kind of Freddy, he's small. And, you know, he's not really somebody who should be kidnapping somebody.
Right, right.
Because he's just not strong enough. And they say that in the movie, that he's just not strong enough to pull this one off. And he's not. And I felt so bad when he was doing his twitching. I mean, every time he would get a little nervous, if she would yell at him, if she would tell him to get out, you know, whatever the case may be, he would go into this shoulder flinging thing and, you know, just go into that, be walking all the way from the cellar to the house with this shoulder thing going on.
Charlie Brown in action.
It's creepy. It's very creepy. And it's very, to me, that was very Hitchcocky in that, you know, he reminded me of Norman Bates.
Very much.
So much with his, you know, not being exactly right.
Right.
He definitely was not exactly right in more ways than one.
Yeah, absolutely. You're right. 1,000%. So she runs for the door. And as he grabs her, he whispers, I love you, almost involuntarily. And they both freeze in shock, which I thought was really funny. They're both like, what? And the story of his stalking spills out. He says, I want you to get to know me. And the depth of his derangement starts to become visible when he, thinking it's romantic, says, it would be worth going to prison for life over this. Besides, they may be looking for you, but nobody is looking for me.
Yeah, I thought that was a great line.
Definitely. And it shows that
you're stuck, lady.
Yeah. And that sense of inferiority that he feels of nobody is looking for me, like, mm-hmm. I think is part of what drove him in the first place, feeling so invisible. She asks how long he intends to hold her, and he says that depends. On what? On my falling in love with you? In that case, I'm going to be here until I die. Now go away, she screams, and he does indeed slink out. Another chance at freedom here, where she fakes a burst appendix. He doesn't believe her, but lures her into a trap by leaving the door open and seeing what she does. And again, this is a moment where you feel so bad for Freddy, where it's like, if you set up this test, of course she's gonna fail it. Like, it's an insane standard to hold somebody to, because you've kidnapped her. Why would she not try to escape?
Right.
But there's a brutal shot of freedom with chirping birds and blue skies at the end of the path, and she does make a dash for it, only to have the door slammed in her face. It wasn't the most convincing a burst appendix, to be fair. But she slaps him and then awaits his reaction in terror. But he just shows her the door, and this time she slams it in his face. He agrees to her conditional release. She has to start eating and talk to him, and don't try to escape like that. And if she does, she can go in 1 month. She's clearly torn up about accepting this, feeling like it's giving up, but she does, after prorating the 4 weeks, which I thought was very funny, and listing a few conditions of her own. It's the 11th, not the 14th.
She was, for a woman back in those days, that was kind of just when, the equal rights stuff was going on, mm-hmm. and first started. She shows what a true woman in the equal rights era acted like.
Mm-hmm.
She was very, and I can attest to that mm-hmm. because I have a sister who's 13 years older than me. So again, I was born in 64. So she was, I don't know what, but she was 13 years older than me. And she was all part of that,
mm-hmm.
Floppy hat and maxi dresses and Carly Simon and James Taylor and, all of these guys playing on the radio. And it just, this particular rendition of the movie just struck me as, wow, they really got the 1960s right.
Mm-hmm. I also really like this scene of him, like, childishly embodying delight as he heads out with their agreement in place. He's, like, skipping through the field, basically.
I'm telling you, he's got something.
I believe it. And so now the sentence begins in earnest. She has agreed to start talking to him, but frankly, he seems like a bit of a drip. She also sees an opportunity to shatter the pedestal she's on by telling him a dirty joke, but he quickly tells her a joke of his own to pacify her. What has 4 ears and 8 legs? 2 dogs. It's not bad. It's not bad at all.
Poor Freddy.
My favorite joke like that is, what do you call a fish with no eyes?
I have no idea.
A fish, because it has no eye.
Okay, I see. That's the word fish. All right, I got it.
So he changes the subject. He says, how about that bath you wanted? But he gets worked up on the way, and he looks like he's going to attack her. And it's pretty frightening even after he calms down, because he says, oh, it won't happen again. But who the hell can trust that? All we have is right. this kidnapper's word.
Right. It's, I know I wouldn't trust him.
Yeah. Bath time commences, and so does looking for a way out. And one seems to present itself when a neighbor comes a-knocking. But Freddy is so quick. He bursts in, he gags her violently, he ties her to a pole nearby, and he attempts to get rid of the neighbor, who's definitely a lingering busybody. But he can't just ignore him, since he's wandering towards the cellar, which is why people would be like, well, just don't answer the door. The lights are on, the guy is wandering towards the dungeon. Something must be done. And so Miranda stretches her leg over, and she starts the bath back up, which floods and grabs the neighbor's attention. This bathwater scene isn't in the book, but is a fun addition, I think. It's very suspenseful.
Yeah, very.
Freddy convinces him that it's his girlfriend and to leave them be, so Miranda's goose is cooked. I love the look on Freddy's face as he emerges from the bathroom. It is terrifying. And it works even more well than he anticipated, with the smirking neighbor saying he'd understand now if Freddy doesn't make it over for the drink that he just invited him for. Yeah. It's agonizing as he walks towards her, and the lack of reaction is almost more frightening than if he had just done something. Mm-hmm. But he only releases her to finish the bath. And when she emerges, he tries to reveal a piece of himself, his hobby of mounting butterflies. And they go into the office, which is absolutely covered in them, cases of the same type even, in every drawer. He's been doing it since he was a boy.
That leaf one was pretty cool.
It is cool, definitely. And she, of course, sees herself reflected in the butterfly cage and picking one up that has a splash of red, just like herself, that helps her make the connection. And the reveal has worked too well. He has deluded himself into thinking that he's done something beautiful, when in fact all he has done is ended living beauty, as she calls it. He scoffs and says, what difference does a few specimens make? But in the book, she correctly points out all the future generations that never got a chance, thanks to this beauty miser, unable to share it with the world. And she rejects it and tries to release his captive one. And he freaks out. He says, don't do that. I may never get another one. Which, first of all, this is the first time that we really see him mad and acting out. But then on top of that, easy to apply that to to his kidnapping of Miranda, where, oh, this is my maybe one chance to have someone here and convince them to like me. He also says there would be more kidnappings if people had the time and money. Another delusion that he is the right one, no matter what anyone might say, and sort of an indicator that for Miranda, there is no way out.
Yeah. Poor Miranda. I just, you know, it's funny because she can have anything she wants there. They'll get her anything that she wants from the store, post office, which, by the way, she tried to sneak a little something into the postal mail, which I'll let George tell you about. But, you know, she's just, I gotta tell you, she's a snoot. She's a snoot. Mm-hmm. She's worried about the fact that she's not a snoot. Mm-hmm. And she just honestly, especially if you read this in the book, she is not a nice person.
No, not at all.
Not at all. And, you know, making fun.
Definitely
and,
in the book. I think it's toned down a little bit.
In the book. Yeah, in the book. She was just so rude. And okay, let's get back to the movie. But she was really an awful person in the book. I didn't like her at all.
It's definitely a shift. And I think that it helps to sort of say that there is that gulf that is impenetrable. But in the movie, because she's a little nicer, you almost feel like, well, maybe she can get Freddy to, like, let her go. Like, maybe yeah. It can work. But she finally recognizes him from his picture in the paper after he won the pools. And she says, go do something. Have a wonderful life. This is death. Nothing but death. Is that what you love? And she walks out, and the gust of wind from the door proves her point. It is death, and they're fragile enough that the breeze destroys several settings. So, you know, it's not real. They're not really there.
No.
Back in the cellar, she's been drawing, and they start to argue about art after he tries to buy her self-portrait, and she tears it up since Freddy doesn't want it because of any quality, just because it's of her, and she says, put it in a drawer with the butterflies. She is placated by the promise of the letter for her mother, which Freddy dictates, but he does feel the additional note that she tries to slip in with it. And he's upset that she says she's frightened in it. Why? What have I done? Asks the kidnapper. And so she offers for them to leave and try to be friends outside, which is when the great social divide between them becomes evident in the movie. He says, people like you can walk into a room and talk to anyone. You understand things. It's different for people like me. And she tries to get through to him, and he says that he will read The Catcher in the Rye and report back.
Ay, ay, ay. I was like, George, are you giving me all these reading assignments? No, I remembered enough from high school. I was like, I gotta read another book.
No, they cover it plenty, I think, in their description of it in this. The themes that they're touching on. But it's their last day. Freedom Day, as her very colorful calendar says, in contrast with his heavy black X's. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a mocking reminder that her attitude hasn't changed at all, as far as he's concerned. and which, yes, obviously, as far as we're concerned. And he also says that he read the book and he didn't much like it. But she doesn't actually discuss it with him, just agrees, because she's afraid of any pushback causing him to change his mind. But this condescension is exactly what he feared, and when she tries to explain what's good about it, he bristles at the idea that famously alienated anti-hero Holden Caulfield could be like him. I do think that this is a really great moment for the character of Miranda, where, like, if you were in that position, it's another trap that you kind of can't get out of. Because if you let him just be right, then you're not actually engaging with him. And, oh, he was right to hold you here because he would never get to talk to you outside. But if you say that he doesn't get it, then he goes, oh, I'm an idiot who doesn't get it, and you think you're better than me. Like, there is no way for her to get out of this.
Get out of it, yes. The mistake was giving him the book to read.
Right.
He's so worried about, he really fixates on his class.
Definitely.
Even though now he's kind of in a different class because of the money that he has. Mm-hmm. But because he's got Miranda kidnapped, he's not using the money to have any kind of
advantages,
nice life,
right?
And,
yeah,
and what have you. So,
yeah,
I thought that was really a shame because I was thinking what I would do. When I figured it out in today's dollars, sure. I was like, oh, come on, guys, I'll get somebody to carry me through the Galapagos.
He did send his aunt and family to Australia, at least in the book.
Yeah.
But I love Miranda's nervous refusal to back down, especially once they move to Picasso. And she says, he's not trying to draw a face as it is. He's trying to draw a face as he sees it, as he feels it. And Freddie, he says, that makes it good? This is a bad joke. Like, he refuses to engage beyond the surface level. And the argument about Salinger and Picasso is greatly expanded from the book. They talk about Salinger a little bit. Picasso is not in the book, but it's a crucial moment. And I think that in this moment, both characters are pretty sympathetic. It's not just an artistic disagreement, but does show the unbridgeable gap between them in culture and perspective. He feels that these paintings are lying, and that the value in a photograph lies in its adherence to truth. But she is explicitly saying, reality is not the benefit of art. And so those two are not compatible. Like, that is not compatible worldviews. And he says, how do I grasp it? While he literally does. He's holding the book. How do I grasp it? It doesn't mean anything. You just say it does because a professor told you it does, so you can all feel superior. And I think that there's a real pathos to his agony as he tears at the book.
That surprised me when he started tearing the book up.
Yeah. And they said, money bought him freedom, but it didn't buy him the education and knowledge that would gain him access to Miranda's world and make emotional contact. And so this has almost been more painful, that he feels like he should be closer, but is all the further away from her than ever before.
Yeah, he should have never done this.
Right.
He should have never done this. And I will just add to the folks listening, keep this in mind. I'm a nurse.
Mm-hmm.
Keep that in mind.
And the scariest part is that he feels vindicated in his actions. He says, you see, I was right to bring you here. We could never have been friends outside. And in another scene of unpredictable nature, he quickly returns with a nice dress that he brought her for what is presumably their final night together. And that
beautiful dress.
That whiplash just totally keeps you off balance, even this late in the game. I do like it's almost a reversal of Cinderella, where she's all dressed up and waiting for the stroke of midnight to release her from Prince Charming, in quotes.
Yeah, yeah. Poor Miranda, when she opened the napkin, I thought I would die.
Oh, man, yeah. The dinner is strange, since he's so glum and she's so excited. She also notices he did actually frame the picture that she jokingly signed with a prisoner number. And when he says that he's going to be lonely, she says she does hope he'll move to London. It would be better for him not to isolate so much. Even as cruel as Miranda is in the book, this sympathy does still exist. I pulled a quote where she says, "I feel sorry for Caliban this evening." She calls him Caliban as a reference to the Tempest. "He will suffer when I am gone. There will be nothing left. He'll be alone with all his sex neurosis and his class neurosis and his uselessness and his emptiness. He's asked for it. I'm not really sorry, but I'm not absolutely unsorry." So it is definitely, he does draw sympathy even in the book.
Yeah, I think that he draws sympathy in the book, and in the movie he draws sympathy with regard to Miranda's treatment of him. But I do still think that she's got an ulterior motive. She always has an ulterior motive. How can I get the hell out of this place?
I mean, who's to blame her?
He's really not going to let me go. I got to come up with a plan. And she can't find any windows or anything, right? She's like, help.
Yeah. And he proposes at dinner, and it is sadly pathetic. He says, "Just live in the house and take my name. I won't ask anything of you." And it would make her a prisoner again. But looking for a way out, she agrees. And the camera closes in on his face. Another unwinnable trap that she has fallen into by trying to deceive him. "Don't you think I know you need witnesses to get married?" he says. And if she said no, then he would say, "Oh, well, I have to keep her here." And if she said yes, then they need witnesses. Again, no way out of this for her. He chloroforms her once again. Really great shot as she backs up against the wall of butterflies, cornered much like they were once. And it's also very Dracula-esque as he carries her up the stairs. It does reinforce kind of a lower level theme where he's vampirically draining her of her vitality, is getting life from taking it away from her, slower than usual, though it may be. And as he lays down in the bed with her, he's still fantasizing about sharing her life and thus cross that frustrating social stratum. It's not really even about her. It's about being part of this world that he wants. So yeah, she wakes up. She says that he's going back on his word. And he says, "You could fall in love with me if you tried, but you won't try." And so she emerges a while later and attempts to seduce him. And I love that, as you say, you think that she has an ulterior motive. But in the movie specifically, when we don't have her library or her journal to back it up, it is kind of unsure whether it's calculated or compassionate. It could be both. It's strongly hinted that it would be both of their first times, and it could be an attempt to liberate herself by liberating him and break through the repression. Mm-hmm. That even if she doesn't actually love him, that she's trying to say, like, sex doesn't have to be this huge deal that you've turned it into. And so it's sort of a final throw of the dice to win power. It is very tragic. It is like this moment where all of the sympathy that we have felt for both of them kind of culminates in this moment of both of them being lonely and isolated here.
Well, poor Freddie thinks he's going to have sex for the first time. And I'm going to say this in front of my son. He's old enough. He can't do it.
He can't do it. He couldn't do it, he's mortified.
What, are you kidding me? After all this, you can't do it?
The pressure was too much. The pressure was too much for him, and he can't do it. The church bell score is interrupted as he rejects her after a few smooches because, as the book is very explicit, he can't get it up, and he's skittish like a deer, and this quick move of her attempting to seduce him, scares him off, it confuses him, he lashes out, calling her disgusting and worse, throws her drawings in the fire while she
weeps. One of the prostitutes in London.
Right. He said, I could buy that at any time. And he ties her up again, and she realizes, I'm never getting out of here alive, am I? And out they go into the rain, but when he goes to unlock the cellar, she smashes him with a nearby spade, causing a gush of bright red blood.
Okay. The blood was a little much, I have to tell you. It looked very unreal, but
I
went along with it.
I like it. I like that it looks fake.
I was like, what did they use for that?
There is a crucial difference in the book during this shovel scene. In that, in the book, She is trying to kill him. And here, the shocked look on her face at the gore suggests that she's just trying to knock him out so that she can escape. And she can't bring herself to strike again. She's horrified because as much as Freddy represents death and repression and Philistinism, she represents life and passion and art. And so she cannot kill him.
Vitality.
Right. But that's what leads to her own death as he grabs her and drags her back into the cellar. She knocks over the heating and being stuck down there, soaked for a few days in an ancient cellar with no food or water.
They had a little space heater.
Right. That's right.
To keep her warm.
He goes to the hospital for a few days. She's still stuck down there. She becomes very, very ill. And ironically, when he returns is the first time she's glad to see him. But he knocks away her hand and does nothing to help her as she collapses. Just puts her back in the bed where she cries at how much she won't get to do. Which is another very potent moment. But when he finally decides to get a doctor, we get a very similar shot to the one of the open doorway before. Only this time, there are no birds singing. And I thought that that was another, really powerful moment. And all she can do is fall back in the bed. And once he gets to the city, he doesn't get a doctor. He can't do it. And he goes to the pharmacy instead. And because he can't release her, he brings in some pills instead. But by the time he gets back, she is dead.
She's gone. She's gone. For momentarily, when I was watching it, and it was the doctor that he went to, I had to try and remember what's her last name because her father's a doctor.
That's right.
And maybe that's why he's not going because that's her father. But as it turns out, it wasn't the same last name.
He just couldn't do it with anyone at all.
No. And poor Miranda.
That's right.
She was such a vital, my God, vivacious and she wanted to live.
Yeah, she wanted to live.
That's all she wanted. She wanted to live. And, here he is, the love of his life. That was
quotes. In quotes.
That was quotes.
Yep.
That was in quotes. The love of his life, and he winds up killing her.
Right.
Because she does have pneumonia, and she gets no treatment for it, and he offs her.
Right. In the book, he wonders if he should kill himself and frame it as a Romeo and Juliet-style suicide pact between lovers. And instead, he, like the book Great Expectations, says, I aim too high. And we see him move on to a nurse, one who is maybe not...
Wait, I forgot to tell where she was buried.
Oh, that's right. In a box under the great elm tree or great oak tree.
Apple tree. I think it was. He buried her in a box and, was like talking to the lump before he goes off to try and find somebody not quite as sophisticated.
That's right. The birth of a serial stalker at best and killer at worst. It is wild. He literally says, I considered the idea it was my fault and then said, no, she did that to herself. Okay, Freddy, I guess you're not going to learn anything from this. I do also really like the credits. It's a soft image of Miranda in happier times with a big smile that fades to a series of mounted butterflies. It's kind of a poignant and tragic encapsulation of the whole story, really, which I think they do a great job with.
Well, you left a part out, really, about the fact that the loser was a nurse.
It's true. She's picked to be next.
I'm like, what the hell? I'm a nurse. I have 3 degrees. Don't be telling me I'm not smart.
Well, I think it's just this lady in particular.
Yeah, no, yes. I don't know. Has he been following around supermarkets and everything?
I guess so. He's about
really
to start.
Show.
Yeah.
But he already has his eyeball on her.
That's right. And now, Mom, we've reached the part of the episode where we sum up why this isn't just a good horror movie, but is in fact the best horror movie of all time. And I'm going to let you start.
Okay, well, I really have to say I do enjoy this movie, and I will probably reread the book as well. And who knows, there are some books I read once a year, The Great Gatsby being one of them. Mm-hmm. Great book. It's on Broadway now. Can't afford it. But the main thing that I liked about this movie was its whole Hitchcockian illusions of how Hitchcock would direct a movie and get us through to the end. Mm-hmm. I, unlike the guys, the people who said that the music was not good, thought the music was great and thought it added tremendously to the movie. And that was kind of like the music was in place of the jump scare.
Mm-hmm.
I learned that word from you. So to me, that really helped me to follow along with, uh-oh, what's going to happen now, you know, and get ready and be suspenseful. So I really enjoyed that. And I thought that Freddie was just terrific with his leaned over thing that he got when, you know, his tell that he's nervous. Mm-hmm. And the fact that, you know, I clearly thought that he was on the spectrum of disorders. And I thought he was terrific.
Yeah.
Because he could go from playing this straight, just dorky, you know, I don't know how to play because I never played when I was little.
Mm-hmm.
And I just think that, you know, I thought that he was great in the part.
Yeah.
She was great too. She won a Golden Globe for it. And, you know, he got a lot of damn money.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, he definitely does a great job with it. To me, this is the best horror movie ever made, because not only does it exist in its own like historical context as a wonderful, wonderful suspense thriller, but in addition to that, it's also very ahead of its time. This obviously plays with male entitlement, which isn't new, but he is almost like a proto-incel. Freddy's fantasy at the beginning of the book is simply, instead of saying almost nothing in case I made mistakes, we were the popular host and hostess. A deranged certainty that the hole inside could be filled by external validation. And this is very similar to the young boys that have bought into the no longer relevant dynamic between men and women, only now they're being further warped by a media culture that features men who so fit it literally becomes unhealthy again, like Zac Efron, and they're being cast in everyman roles. The media is saying, this is what an average man looks like.
Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, it's the most handsome guy you ever saw in your damn life.
Right.
And so these boys say, I don't look like that, so that's why women don't like me. It's not my abhorrent opinions. There's always someone else to blame. And there are lots of grifters who are willing to take advantage of this. And the victims spiral out, thinking that it's all women want, and it leads to the dissonance that we see so well typified here, which is a felt inferiority that manifests as superiority in both culture and emotion. He says, I am right. Everyone would do the things that I am doing if they had the money. Because he cannot accept that he has not had a typical upbringing, and so this has warped his perspective.
Yeah.
But as much as it's about Freddie, it's also as much about the resilience of Miranda.
Yeah.
And not just the tale of this budding serial killer, because she can't see that she can't actually be what this guy wants, which is essentially a combination of the Madonna and whore archetypes. So she keeps digging and keeps trying. From the very beginning, where she's negotiating the length of her stay, to the final moments of her life, she never stops trying to be free and to exist. And because she's experienced love and life, she has more of that to her. That's what drew Freddy to her. She is this butterfly flapping its wings despite being in the killing jar. And so much like the book, it is imbued with both perspectives, even though Miranda's perspective is different from the book. So in that way, it is an incredible adaptation, in that it captures the dual perspectives, makes you feel sympathy for both of them, but is still very much doing its own thing, and an example of what is so great about these mid-60s films. You know, it has such a great look to it, that dreamlike vibe that came through in some of the close-ups, the gauziness. It's just really great.
The real tight, those real tight close-ups, mm-hmm. where you almost, it almost made me dizzy when they pulled in like that and you know, kind of hovered.
Mm-hmm.
That made me dizzy. But I also wanted to ask you, did you notice that the butterfly that she picked up by the pin had red in it?
Yeah.
For her hair?
That's right.
And I guess, you know, that was the best way that it kind of showed you exactly what was happening.
Ooh, that's right.
Look at that red-haired butterfly.
Yep.
It's dead. And oh boy, look
that's
at
right.
that red-headed Miranda. She's next.
Yeah, and she says, what you love is your own love. It's not love, it's selfishness. It's not me you think of, but what you feel about me.
Yeah.
And I think that nails it on the dang head.
Yeah. So I just one question real quick, George.
Sure, sure.
When I told you I wanted to do The Collector,
mm-hmm.
and, you know, told you it was from 1965, blah, blah, blah. Did you think I had rocks in my head picking such an old movie?
No. There are plenty of great movies from the 60s.
It just reminded me when the first time I watched it, I was like, oh my God, this is Alfred Hitchcock.
Yeah,
and
definitely.
Then I said, no, it's not.
I mean, I would probably say that Psycho is in my top three, and that's 1960 flat. So,
yeah. Well, this totally reminded me of Psycho.
Yeah, definitely. He's got a lot of Norman Bates to him.
You know, yeah. And,
it's like
know,
the different ways hates, the sex
hates
mania.
The mother
right.
hates the aunt. And, yeah. You know, the whole nine yards. So,
that's
George,
right.
thank you for having me on. This has been, I have been so excited to do this, and I love you so much. And thank you for having me on. And I hope we get good ratings for your sake. But my $8 is still floating over your way.
Well, I love you as well. And I'm thrilled that we got to do this for episode 200. Ordinarily, we would be moving into plugs time now. I presume you do not have any projects that you want to plug. But I know that there are a lot of organizations that you like to support. And I thought this would be a good time.
Yes, there are a lot of organizations that I support. If maybe I'll just name three things that I'm very interested in. First of all, I do have mental illness, but it's all under control with my medications. So one of the organizations that I like to support is NAMI, which is the National Association of Mental Illness. And that all those monies go towards programming and what have you for mentally ill people. My next one is the Equal Justice Initiative. Every year, that's where my presents go, Mother's Day, birthday, everything. So that's a biggie for me, is the Equal Justice Initiative. And then the other one that I really like is the Prison Mindfulness Project. So you can see I'm very much into rehabilitation with regard to the prison population, most of whom don't even belong in prison, but need some sort of psychiatric place that they can go and get real treatment instead of the treatment that they get now, which
definitely.
Is a clock over the head.
Well, I definitely encourage you all to help my mother in supporting these programs. As she said, we often donate to the Equal Justice Initiative ourselves, me, that being myself and the other children in the family. So certainly encourage you all to check that out if you're looking for some great programs.
Thank you, George.
Sure. As far as my plugs, check out the back catalog, dog. The show is ending, so I'm not really going to plug anything going forward, but there's lots of great stuff in the past. And also, there is still good stuff coming up, but I'm just saying, there's already no need to wait. The last couple episodes even have all been great. Nick Weiger talking about Ninja Scroll. John Gabris talking about Cat's Eye. Go a little further back, you see Paul Rust talking about Psycho. If you want to have that actual Hitchcock discussion. I know my mom loves Hereditary based on the discussion.
Oh, yeah, from watching this.
That's right.
I would have never known about it. Yeah, I love Hereditary.
So go listen to very, very early on. We did
also,
Hereditary.
George, what's the one I never can think of the name?
Oh, Get Out?
Get Out. Watch Get Out if you haven't watched it yet.
It's a good one.
Cool.
Good one, and great ep on it. So definitely check those things out. That's it. Thanks, everyone. Bye.